The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy,
but we have main engine start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Tuesday Space Show. Great to be here again, and thank you all for tuning in. A couple of quick announcements. First, just a heads up, in the San Francisco Bay Area, we're having one of our big winter storms. So if the Space Show suddenly goes dead, it's probably nothing wrong with your system. It probably means we lost power, or the wind has knocked us out, or the cable system has been knocked down someplace in the Bay Area. So don't panic, and if we can't get back up, we will reschedule the show. This happens during our rainy season every year, so just a heads up on that, that that's what's going on here tonight. If you would like to call us and talk to our most interesting guest, Don Davis, I'll tell you about him in just a minute, that toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let it ring until it can be answered, and I'll bring you up on the air just as quickly as possible. If you prefer using email, our addresses are, as always, drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and dmlivings@yahoo.com. Remember that we are trademarked and copyrighted, but you can copy these shows, download them, spread them around, do what you want to distribute them and get the word out about why space is so valuable. Please remember, nothing commercial and no changes or modifications to the context of any of the shows. So, you know, don't edit them or anything like that. And for those of you who want to use chat, remember we use IM, ICQ, and CompuServe through the AOL system. The screen name is the same for all three of those systems, lowercase, one word, space, show, chat. It is up and running and visible right now. If for any reason you don't see it on your IM system, please send me an email at drspace@thespaceshow.com and let me know, and I'll see about rebooting it or doing something to make sure that the problem is not here at my end. We do podcast, and Andrew at Gigadial arranges this for us. Great service. The RSS URL is on our website, both of our newsletters. We're iTunes compatible. Search for The Space Show or my name. We're in Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com in South America, lots of other places around the world, too, and including the new location, which I've been announcing. Let's see if I can find it real quick. It is WI Astronomy. So it's www.wiastro.com. And I'll have a link there that says Cool Podcasts, and we're listed there as well. Do remember that the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. I think I'll skip Hold the Break, Hold the Dates, and not do them tonight. They're a little bit off in the future anyway. I do want to tell you about our guest today, and it's an honor and a pleasure to introduce to all of you Donald Davis. He is a space artist and animator, photographer, and writer. Excuse me. His first memory of a news event was the orbiting Sputnik. This goes back to 1957. He started his professional career in the space art career, and he was as a high school student in the late 60s, around 1968, as a scientific illustrator for the U.S. Geological Survey branch of the Astrogeological Studies. That was in Menlo Park in California, just south of San Francisco. His supervisor was Don Wilhelm, and he worked in shaping landscapes of the Earth, Moon, the Mars, and many of his artistic influences were the work of Chesley Bonestell, Charles Knight, and other great dinosaur painters, and the growing awareness of the beauty of nature, which began with his book, The Nature of Light and Color in the Open Air. And he met Chesley in the 1960s. He's painted numerous works illustrating planetary exploration and visualizations of space colonies for NASA. He also did the team of artists for Cosmos with Carl Sagan. You all remember that, the PBS series. His full bio is going to be up on the website. It's also linked in the write-up of this on the website newsletter, so you can find it on his website, which is DonaldEDavis.com. You can go to it as we're talking, and you'll see he's got links to quite a few things, and one of them on the upper left says bio, and you can get even more information than what I'm reading. Let's talk to Don Davis and not read about him. Don, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm quite fine, thank you.
Tell us how you got into space art and space, and give us some background about you.
Well, a lot of our background is the historical context we grew up in, and as you mentioned, one news event that our kindergarten teacher insisted on impressing upon us toddlers was the launch of Sputnik. And of course, seeing on TV the reruns of the Disney Man in Space programs, and let's see, there was a show Men into Space, which used some of Bonestell's artwork. That was a fun space adventure show. Although there was a lot of reinforcement for people interested in space in that era, and of course the Mercury and Gemini programs and such. And around that time, my mom gave me a book. It was a smaller edition of the great compilation by the editors of Life, The World We Live In. And that's probably the greatest collection of nature art put together by different artists ever put into one volume. And the beginning and the end of that volume were the works of Chesley Bonestell. And in the beginning showing the formation of the Earth and the lurid primordial landscapes, and at the end, the visions of space. And in between, among all the other nature work, just incredible, with the dinosaur paintings, this giant mural that Rudolf Zellinger created for the Peabody Museum of Natural History. It was an almost photoreal, immensely detailed painting that absorbed my attention for countless hours.
And did you study art? How did you start doing this yourself?
My first recollection, I was given a paint-by-number set, and I threw away the board and started creating little pictures based on some of the images that appealed to me on little pieces of card or whatever. And over the years, I learned more about the artists, realizing that these were things that people create and imagine, and I never had any formal art training. I took art classes in high school, of course, and such, and picked up what I learned from people who were professionals in the subject.
Amazing. And so from the art, you got into really understanding the importance and the necessity to develop space and to even move out into space for humanity, right?
In a circuitous fashion, when people were looking at the U.S. Geological Survey for people to color these maps, you see, back then, they would put out these, they would draw the geologic maps, and they would look like basically outlines of jigsaw puzzles, and each of these little areas were marked with different coded names for geologic units, and so they would hire people out of high school, like me, to take sets of colored pencils, keyed to each of these units, and accurately color in sort of a cheap hand human process before we had readily available large color duplicators. And so I went in for my interview and met Don Wilhelms and brought a painting of the moon, an oil painting of the moon. And he looked at that and hired me on the spot. It turned out he had another project in mind that he didn't have the talent ready to put to work on it. That was a couple of reconstructions of the appearance of the moon in past geologic eras. And they had at that time, before the Apollo missions, the relative ages of the different big events on the moon, but they didn't have the absolute ages. So I ended up doing a couple of paintings, one showing the moon before all the freshest craters, the ones that leave these star pattern-like ray patterns across the surface. And although the dark Maria lava was still had already reached its present level, and then an earlier era before the dark Maria lava plains covered the lowlands, and there are these large impact basins that can be traced through chains of mountains and other traces that poke above the lava. And we had just learned about the appearance of these large impact basins when the lunar orbiter photos of the Orientale Basin were first shown. And that was, in fact, the basin was first recognized by a team of people, including Bill Hartman, back about 1962, when they were projecting images of the moon onto globes and looking at the edges and seeing what might show up that was made more clear by seeing it being seen in a vertical perspective. So anyway, older, more degraded versions of all these basins can be recognized across the front of the moon, and so I learned a good amount about lunar history in the process of creating these images. And that those two paintings, along with a mosaic of the present moon, were published in the magazine Icarus, which was edited by Carl Sagan at the time. And in my course of work for the USGS, I did many illustrations for scientific papers and learned a lot about the forces shaping the landscapes of the moon and Mars.
When you were learning this and doing this work, did you ever view or visualize space as a destination for people to go or to leave this planet and go, or did that come much later?
No, it was in fact, that kind of vision was probably at its peak at that time, because the space program really seemed to be a program back then. There seemed to be a genuine momentum toward lunar exploration and perhaps settlement. And so definitely, me and a lot of people hoped that they would one day be able to go into space. But in the meantime, we were just having our nearby worlds unveiled in the most dramatic fashion. We still knew next to nothing about Mars, and space probes were just beginning to give us some hint. And although a lot of people think the moon is boring, actually it's quite exciting. It's a very interesting place. If you're looking for some traces of what the conditions of the inner solar system were like in the very early eras, whereas the Earth geology, we can go back maybe 10% or so with a few scraps beyond of our history, and have fairly good knowledge of that. Everything gets reworked and destroyed before that, and we have the moon and other worlds that give us some idea of what was going on in the cosmic neighborhood during these vast, previously unknown stretches. And, of course, the moon landings brought us the rocks and the ability to determine the absolute ages of different types of lunar materials and terrain, and that began to give us the context, and things began to fit in, and the grand picture began to emerge.
Here's your first question. It's from Allison in Salt Lake City, and Allison says, David mentioned Cosmos when he was introducing you. My favorite series of all time. I wish it were still going on somehow. What was it like involved in the artistic work for Cosmos, and what was Carl Sagan like?
Oh, it was a fantastic project. A good friend of Carl's and collaborator was the artist John Lomberg, and he was basically the fellow who gathered together the artists who worked on the series with input from Carl. And so it was interesting. Many of the artists had done work for Carl and doing illustrations and such before, and Carl tended to gather the talent around him that was brought to bear on areas of a perceived specialty that they were the best at. So I ended up being responsible for creating the models of the surfaces of the various planets and some globes and other miscellaneous artwork, tabletop models, including a couple of the Velis Marineris and such, and So I would work hard to create the things and make them look right. And Carl, he was among the most perceptive people I ever looked at and reviewed a piece of work that I did. He would know, he would recognize the subtleties, and if he had some issue with it, he would articulate it, and it was a joy working with him.
So by the time everything made it to Cosmos, he actually had pretty much made sure everything was precise and accurate.
He had gathered the talent together, again, with the help of John Lomberg, who was at that time the head of the artists group. And he was the one who was doing a lot of the networking at that time. And it was great fun. There were other artists, Rick Sternbach, quite a few others here and there that, anyway, we ended up winning collectively, or actually in those days they gave them out individually, Emmy Awards for the visual effects work. So I got an Emmy on my mantelpiece as a fond memory of that show. It was a great show. It was, back at PBS they used to call it Cosmos because it was extremely expensive for a show at that time.
It was so cutting edge and so incredible. And, it, you know, when I see reruns of it, and I mean, it still holds up today. It was an amazing program.
It does,
program.
Although they've chopped away at it mercilessly and metamorphosed it into something different and in some ways, I don't know, perhaps not quite as familiar as the material that I recall back then. But who knows? Maybe they'll keep doing updates as more facts come in.
Well, clearly the facts are coming in. Have you seen a, maybe surge is not the right word, but an increase in public interest, demand, awareness in space art and imaging over the years, or did it peak and settle back down, or is it still peaking?
That's a good question. I think in the publishing field, it's been in a steady decline for quite a few years. Part of that is probably driven by the budgets of many publishers. And you look at many rack magazines and the newsstands, and it's astonishing to see how slim they've gotten. And so as far as print, the peak era for that was probably in the 1950s. And space art, of course, was nurtured a lot in the public mind as far as being introduced in fairly widely subscribed publications. The Illustrated London News was, they hired a lot of great artists, and one of them was a fellow named Scriven Bolton, who in 1927 painted this rather craggy-looking lunar landscape. But he actually had advanced methods of, he would create models and paint on top of that. And then another artist, Lucien Rudeau, he was a great space artist, probably the earliest modern astronomical painter in some ways. And then, of course, Chesley Bonestell. All three of these painters had work in the Illustrated London News. Then we had the science fiction magazines, Fantasy and Science Fiction, Galaxy, and Analog, etc. A lot of astronomical space art would appear on those covers. And then Life magazine. Life had actually a big debut of astronomical art in the May 29th, 1944 issue, where Chesley Bonestell had a series of paintings of Saturn seen from its various moons, including the iconic Saturn seen from Titan, with a crescent Saturn and a blue sky with the snowy, craggy landscape. Collier's in the early 50s was another very important publication. A lot of great space art was shown there, and some of it was an outgrowth of these symposiums at the Hayden Planetarium. And anyway, it was very that was a great time. And I think nowadays, although there are people doing space art and publications carrying it, a lot of it seems to be moving to the digital realm.
Well, yeah, everything seems to be going digital. But, you know, what I notice is that so much of, and I'm 63, as I told you before the show, but so much of what drove my passions and excited me as a kid was Collier's, was the early space art, was, you know, what I saw on early television, Cosmos, you know, that whole realm of the 50s and the 60s. And, you know, my kids grew up in the 80s and the 90s, and that wasn't really there, or there was so much more material that you didn't notice the space stuff as much. It really stood out in my age group, in my generation. But if it was there in the 80s and the 90s, it got lost in the chatter and the ether of everything else.
Well, there were quite a few space artists active in the field, and the organization I belong to, the International Association of Astronomical Artists, we're a group of artists that maintain our communication with each other and watch each other's backs as far as copyright infringement, and give each other professional and artistic tips and such. So there's a good group of people that maintain in touch and maintain contacts in the publishing world. So we know most of them. That's kind of how small a number is, but it is a very potent and energetic and imaginative group.
One of the things I noticed on your website was that you have a discussion on the true colors of Mars. And can you take us through a little bit of that? Because I've heard things on other radio shows for years about this color is faked and it's really not this, and, you know, there is dust in the atmosphere and it's really blue like on Earth. And what are some of the facts and myths around the colors on Mars?
Well, let me just back off a little and mention my passion with trying to get the colors right. It is as an artist would be, going about seeing what color various waters and different parts of the world or landscapes are. And in Sky and Telescope, they had an issue, the May 1985 issue, where there was an article on the colors of the solar system by Andrew T. Young. And he was, I guess, on the imaging team of Viking. And anyway, he's done a fair amount of rigorous work trying to divine out what the true colors are based on telescopic and spacecraft observations. And so he had little color trips published, which were representative of mean values. And then I wrote to him, and he complained that, you know, any reproduction in any magazine, it's going to vary from the source material to some extent. In fact, he was even soliciting people to send him copies so he could see if there was an average of the different variations of printing. So he sent me a set of color chips that were much closer, and that was the basis of my trying to incorporate these into future paintings. And I have a Colors in the Solar System page on my site where I've got examples of trying to get the colors approximately right. And there's so many variables in this, it's really hard to nail down, because you've got a screen you're looking at, it's not as bright as sunlit stuff, and there are color variations. All you can do is try your best. And Mars ended up still being a fair amount of attention being paid to that spacecraft landing there and such, and giving us more and more data. So the interesting thing, there was an article in Journal of Geophysical Research that had a couple of reproductions of color pictures from the Martian surface, and it ended up being very kind of a yellowish dark brown color on the average. And Mars is actually quite dark as well. It's the albedo and it's pretty low. Anyway, so it ended up, it's sort of a dark cinnamon color, sort of. And it's the careful examination of the Viking and later the Pathfinder images, they devoted a fair amount of work to that as well. Anyway, the Martian surface, the dust, is this dark yellowish-brown colored powder, and the rocks are basically a darker neutral gray. And so that the sky is also a variation of the dust. It's saturated with dust, so it's the sunlight bouncing off the dust color. And that was a big surprise, of course, seeing that first Viking picture, how bright the sky looked. Now, it's an interesting process with looking at pictures, there's a couple of ways where the public gets pictures from Mars. And in the case, for instance, of the Mir landing pictures, they release on a daily basis just about preliminary JPEGs of all the pictures. These are a quick look for the public, and it's really nice to see the details of the landscape, but they are preliminary products, and they cannot be used for putting together a color picture with the expectation of getting a true result. But unfortunately, the people that I see who have on the web tried to proclaim that the Martian sky is really blue and the rocks look blue, these are the results of using the preliminary JPEG images for such work instead of the later true picture data, which are released at regular intervals at the planetary data facilities. So the differences between what you get when you get JPEG preliminary release to try to get a color image and the actual data are shown on that page I have on the colors of Mars. A very simple, quick summary of the problems with the JPEG images is with each image, they have the simple-minded means of stretching the image so that the brightest part of the image looks white and the darkest part looks black. And sometimes you clip off some of the highlights and such, but it's just a quick and dirty means of getting the image out. But the actual data, you actually see that none of the parts of the image are going to look white except for very rare circumstances. The green filter is usually a pretty decent impression of the gray tones in the landscape. The red filter shows you a similar scene but a little lighter, and the blue shows a similar scene but a little darker. And when you look at the spectrum, you see this pretty clear slope where less light is reflected on the blue end and more light is reflected on the red end. And so the light and dark areas have similar slopes but of different heights. So in most cases, the dark areas are just slightly less red, or they have less dust on them, exposing more of the rock. So anyway, it's easier to show than to tell. So it's interesting to compare the results and just see what you get with real data as opposed to the very preliminary data, which can be very misleading when you try to misuse it in that way.
How is the public supposed to know that they may be looking at pictures on a website that are made from the preliminary data? Is there a telltale rule or something like that that we can follow?
Well, ideally, the person putting up the image should say that it's based on such preliminary data. But in general, if the sky looks blue and the rocks look blue, then it's probably based on either preliminary data or severely stretched other data. Probably the best site to get some idea, I don't have the URL handy, but the PanCam website, it's run by Jim Bell, has a large collection of images. And the idea I think he's trying to do is to show what the camera is telling us. And so as a result, you see some variation. There's exposure changes and lighting changes and whatever. But in general, though, I think that's the best place to look to show people what the camera is actually telling us.
When we look at a picture from the Hubble spacecraft, and I mean, you know, the colors, the shapes, all of it are just mind-boggling. Are we able to rely on those colors as being real, or are they somehow enhanced? Or
in general, the caption will tell you when enhancement has been applied and such. And actually, in the case of Hubble, relatively few images are shot in any attempt to produce natural color because the information most readily showing hidden stuff is not in the visual wavelengths. But again, in recent years, Jim Bell has used Hubble to photograph Mars during oppositions, and his images are probably the best use of Hubble as far as trying to get it to look right. I had an interesting opportunity to observe Mars through the 60-inch at Mount Wilson a couple of times, And the first time I was graciously invited along on this trip that Andy Chaikin arranged, where people can buy time on the telescopes and take a look. So the seeing conditions weren't the best in the world, but it was amazing to see Mars that large in the telescope, and you could see color variations across the disk, which are not as severely affected by mediocre seeing. So I had two occasions to make sketches and get some idea of comparing one part of Mars to another, and to get some idea through a good-sized telescope. And it's quite an interesting thing.
I didn't know the public could buy time on Mount Wilson. That's available?
Yes.
Do you have any idea what it costs?
Oh, it's not cheap. It's some hundreds of dollars, but I forget the exact. Certainly, you arrange it well in advance and show up and hope that the weather's good.
Yeah, and hope that there's no more fires in the area.
One of the things we saw that night, Andy and I and the other folks gathered after looking at Mars, was they aimed a telescope at the Orion Nebula. And
uh-huh.
That's just an amazing sight. But the central regions through a 60-inch is probably the most incredible sight I've ever seen through a telescope in my life. You could see color in the nebula. Of course, the central, what they call the trapezium region, is this curdled green-looking cloudy region. That greenish color, turquoise, can be seen in even a modest telescope. But along the fringes of the reddish areas, there was a couple of highlighted regions where the pink color was bright enough to excite human color vision. So you could actually see some hint of the color that you saw in the photographs.
Were you there all night? Was like
yes.
It's an all-night party.
Yes, until dawn.
Boy, would that be a cool 65th birthday party for the space show and for me?
Oh, yes, sure, certainly. It's fun. The seeing is the illumination by the city lights, of course, it compromises the dim stuff. But for planetary work, it's fine, and some of the brighter nebulas.
Don, let's take our first break, and we'll be back with more listener questions and more discussion in about 2 minutes. So don't go anyplace, listeners. We are coming right back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
Well, that's interesting. That's a CD that has gone bad, Don. Going back to announcements, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, remember that we are doing a talk show, and the goal for this year is that you all should use the toll-free line instead of email all the time. So that number is 1-866-687-7223. And the website for our guest today, and you might want to take a look at it as we're listening to this show and discussing things with Don, is www.donaldedavis.com. Don, one of the essays that you've written which intrigued me is your opinion on UFOs. And do you paint UFOs?
No.
No UFO artistry?
Not interesting to me in that regard.
Okay. What's your opinion on it, and why are they not interesting?
Well, because basically what we're being told by the UFO body of literature, as far as I can tell, is more of a projection of our fantasies upon the static of the infinite. It's like the noise, it's the noise on the observations where people are finding pictures out of. You can almost literally, like, back in the days before digital TV, you could look at snow on an image and trace a line on the snow, and a group of people could agree that they see a persistent circle there for some time. It's very old, interesting way of the human race kind of reaching out for its conception of the ultimate. Back in the old days, people used to see nature spirits and saints or whatever, and then nowadays people don't really believe in their hearts overall, that is, in religion the way they used to. And now the ultimate is now wearing a technological guise, and they are aliens of a far advanced culture in their spaceships and such. So I that is the basics of it. The there's a lot of outright fraud and a lot of, you know, it's a cottage literature, and starting in the late 40s and such. It was intriguing. It was fun to read these stories when you're a kid and such. But as time passes and the world gets more and more documented, and even a bright meteor will get recorded by cameras and such, it seems that these reports are retreating into further and further into obscurity as our coverage of the night sky gets more and more complete. Now, on the other hand, I can't resist occasionally indulging in my own crackpot fantasies about UFOs. And if I had to pick a scenario that would match the more believable claims and such, I'd have to say that my concept, or if you would, my idea of the ultimate is that we are being visited by ourselves using some form of time machine or some ability to look back into time. And they are ourselves looking back at us. That would explain how they could avoid being well-documented, because they have access to the historical record. So I guess if you...
Now that's interesting, yeah.
If you really want to see something amazing, and you happen to see something, you can't tell anybody, or they'll go back and make sure it didn't happen.
it had to come in as a question. This is Robert in San Diego, California, and he says, speaking of aliens, did you see Avatar, and what did you think of the artwork and the creativity?
I have not yet, and I'm sure it's dazzling. I will see it in 3D over here at the Desert IMAX soon enough. Apparently it is one of those breakthrough cinema movies like 2001 A Space Odyssey was, and to an extent The Matrix. So I owe myself to get a good look at it, and I love 3D movies as well. And amazing what a comeback 3D has been making in recent years.
It's different 3D because it's not a mixture of the red and green. It's all done with polarized light.
Yes, really classy 3D.
So, it's classy 3D. It is darker. You can take the glasses off, and it's not totally blurred and out of focus. You could probably watch it without the glasses with some marginal 3D getting through to you, but you don't see that green and red, you know, blurring where you take the glasses off in general. And it's really amazing, the visualizations, the graphics, all of that are amazing. And it's remarkable to me how these movies always have gorgeous aliens.
Well, they have to be attractive and what you can relate to. And the technology available now with motion capture has never been better. And now, speaking of cinema milestones that are influential, I have to mention 2001, A Space Odyssey. That film was, I saw it back when 70-millimeter prints were common. In fact, I saw it about 40 times in 70-millimeter theaters. You could, back then, Stanley Kubrick actually supervised, or he personally reviewed every 70-millimeter print. Astonishing. So I found that out later. You could take binoculars and look at people in the little windows of the various spacecraft and the effect shots. And anyway, that was just, it also, besides the wonderful visuals and the mystical, overwhelming sense of infinity, it introduced me to some forms of music that I really hadn't paid attention to, like late Romantic classical and some of the funny avant-garde music, Ligeti and such. I would have never probably known about some of the branches of music that I now know of if I hadn't seen that film.
You do know that someone died watching Avatar?
No, I don't know. A heart attack?
I think it was in Asia, and he actually had some kind of heart or some related problem while watching the movie, and was taken to a hospital, and he was able to live for 11 days, and then he died, and they're blaming it on the movie.
Well, statistically, I mean, sooner or later, someone's going to croak in an audience from a lot of things, so...
No, I just think it's, you know, who knows if he really died because of Avatar, but they're saying he was obviously very impacted by it, so...
I guess so.
You know, I wonder if Cameron sent him the family a condolence note. Did you know O'Neill, because you do talk about and you have a passion for the high frontier and moving off this planet, and your essay certainly talks about Gerard K. O'Neill and the question he asked his class. Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
Oh, yes. No, quite a few times. I worked with him.
Oh, okay.
And I first heard about the space colony concept in a local newspaper. Back then it was the Palo Alto Times that carried an article, I think it was called A Colony in Space by the 1980s or something like that. It was an early piece of artwork of the colony and a description of the idea, and it was just, I was amazed. It just, something lit up inside me when I read that. And then I sought out the author behind it all. So I found Gerard O'Neill, called him up, wrote him, and he sent me back some thoughts about what he thought the interior of one of the large cylinders might look like. And the image that he gave me was imagining being on the Sausalito side of the Golden Gate Bridge, looking out and at this big panorama of... fairly dense but nicely wooded urban area and such, and boats and such things. So I was intrigued, and I ended up creating this painting of a perspective view inside the Model 3 giant cylindrical space colony, big enough for millions of people to live in. And that was done in August of 1975. The green hills of the San Francisco Bay Area were my model as far as my utopian location. And you can see the miniature bridge and the cities stretching out to the distance. That's probably my most influential painting that I ever did. And it became a NASA work that was endlessly reproduced.
Interesting. But you have a passion for moving out into space colonization as a way to benefit humanity and to make a huge difference.
I think that ultimately is the best hope that the human race has for survival, period, as well as survival of whatever it is that people value in society and in personal freedom. As time goes on, you have to regulate people's lives more as the world becomes more crowded, just as like a traffic cop kind of a thing. So in general, I think you'll find that the denser the population, the less personal freedoms people are allowed. And you can't start a new nation anymore on Earth. You'll be stepping on somebody else's turf and inviting bloodshed or being wiped out. So I think that ultimately being able to build new nations in giant terrariums, space colonies, is probably the best long-term hope. Also is a way of backing up the best of humanity. So in case there's a nuclear war or some kind of pandemic that wipes out most of civilization, then there will be places where the human race will go on. And back when the paperback edition of The High Frontier was being put together, Gerry O'Neill and I, we talked about a lot of things regarding space colonies. And he collaborated with me on helping on what should be drawn. So I did quite a few black and white illustrations that appeared in that edition. And anyway, it was interesting. O'Neill, he was a wonderful man, a real visionary, and I wish he were around now to help us along.
Well, he left us way too early. There's no doubt about that. You have a question from Ted in Chicago, and he says, a minute ago you mentioned personal freedom. I'm wondering, now that you mentioned that, if that could be the reason why no government looks to advocate or suggest space colonization. If, in fact, regulation of people is more and more inevitable, and we seem to be seeing that in our country as well as others around the world, the last thing a government would want to do would be supportive of a place or a destination or something that enabled people to have more personal freedom. Do you think that might be why space colonization is not part of a civil space program?
No, not at all. I don't think governments look that far ahead, frankly. That would be, I just think there's no money for it, but some time ago, I guess in the originally, the idea was as an outlet for humanity and a new place for people to live. And later on, the satellite solar power station idea began to gain prominence, and that was then seen as a likely primary industry of the space colonists, building those as well as building new space colonies. So if you could replicate double the amount of real estate available in space colonies every several years or whatever, eventually you'd have so much empty space there that you'd have lots of room for people. And there's a lot of people who think they have ideas of how society should be and such, and I think these people should be given a chance to create a society and just try it out. If it doesn't work out, they've got nobody to blame but themselves.
Do you think it should be part of our civil space policy to do this with public money, or do we privately have to figure out how to get off this planet?
I don't know. Once private industry can get people in large parcels into low Earth orbit, then that'll be a real opening of the door, I think. That'll be a real tipping point. So as we work toward that presumed future capability, it's something to think about.
But nothing's going to happen anytime soon.
No, I think there are people now that are trying to revive the satellite solar power station idea, and I still think it has great merit. But if you look at it and from what little I've talked about other people with, when you compare the costs of that method of power versus practically anything else, it's just not a very favorable cost comparison.
No, for sure it's not. But in California, we have that deal to try to force it with PG&E and the San Diego company Solaren. So we may see something come of that. I'm not particularly optimistic, but anything could happen.
Well, we've got a number of issues in the background of this, and one of these is the idea that sooner or later we're going to reach a peak oil, as they say, where something like half of the oil that we're ever going to get has already been taken out of the earth. And there's all kind of arguments as to whether it's right around the corner or whether it's already happened, and kind of like some other things. But it just seems that when Apollo took place and the immediate aftermath, that was when Gerard O'Neill came up with his idea about, is the surface of a planet the best place for an expanding technical civilization? And the idea of using lunar materials emerged from our experience with actually being in another world and seeing what resources are available. So lunar materials being used as raw material to build space complexes and what he called the bootstrap process. I think that is still a valid thing, and satellite solar power stations could be made as well as colonies and such. They just have to figure out a way to get the cost per pound to orbit way down, and that's real tough.
Yes, it is. You have our first caller for the evening. Caller, are you with us, please?
Yes, I am.
And this is John. I recognize the voice from Montana. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thanks.
Hello.
Being able to call on.
Can you hear him,
hello,
Don?
He's muffled, but I can hear him.
Okay.
Okay. I noticed that around the time of Shoemaker Levy 9, you did a number of paintings that were associated with that event. How does that fit in overall in significance to your entire series of paintings or your career? Was it an unusually important aspect of your career, or was it just part of the overall career, or how do you rank that?
When I first heard about the impending collision, it just lit the fire within me, and I immediately got a hold of everybody who I thought would know anything at all about it, the subject, and picked their brains. And I even went to a Impact Symposium over in Salt Lake City in the aftermath of that to help to absorb a lot of the information that they gathered. So I considered it very important because it was an impact event, which normally are so few and far between, you might as well be talking about the splitting of the continents or something. But to have something like this actually happen that we could observe, and we even had a spacecraft in a position to see it from a distance, it was just absolutely amazing. So I did a series of paintings beforehand and a couple of paintings afterwards. And I did a similar view in one case where what we thought it would look like and what it actually would have looked like after the fact. And there are differences that were incorporated. I was able to improve upon it and make it look as close as I could to what I thought it would look like. And it would have been dramatic indeed.
Yeah, it certainly was. But I assume that in terms of overall significance, Apollo lit your fire a little more.
Well, sure. Like Apollo brought us a lot of the knowledge from which a great deal of our information and our the impetus to explore other worlds was largely on the coattails of Apollo. So, yeah, I would say it was not like a major influence as much as a use of the abilities that I'd gathered up to that time, and it was very timely. And who knows? You know, there are other events that will have happened and will happen that I will keep my eye out for.
Does your fire get lit at all with anything with the International Space Station?
Not really. It's just not exciting to me. It's low Earth orbit, and I really don't care about low Earth orbit. A big bunch of money went into that, and I guess people can justify it as all kinds of grounds, but the one thing I wish they would do more is use the cameras that are on there to look down on the Earth and put that all the time on NASA TV, all the time that they're not actually showing a mission. I'd rather see that than I think it would be an excellent use of the resources in a passive sense, just to at least give us share with us in real time more of that. Usually only during missions do we get to see the long, beautiful views of the Earth going by below us.
Well, go ahead, John.
I was just wondering, do you have an interest in the really big themes, galaxies colliding?
Oh, yes. Wonderful stuff. Galaxy clusters. We're doing a planetarium show, visual effects for now, about different star systems and such. And exciting things. The nice thing about space art is you've got a tremendous region to pick subjects from.
Absolutely. I actually think NASA TV is probably the only TV channel in the world designed to not have viewers. And otherwise, there's no explanation for it.
During a mission, there's no better site, no better channel to see. And they padded out a lot in between missions. And it just seems like they're underutilizing that resource. But during a mission, there's nothing better.
Yeah, absolutely. John, what were you going to say?
I was just saying that it's designed to put you to sleep, I think.
Well, I guess they have a lot of... Well, I don't want to say anything unkind, but just think that it's underutilized.
Do you get in front of students a lot and get a chance to talk to them? Can you ascertain any difference in students today from a few years or a decade or so past regarding space?
Not really. Once in a while, I'll give a talk in front of students, and usually they're interested. There's always some people in there that are going to be fascinated and some people that will just be bored. But it's just like anything else. There's always people out there who can be inspired by something, and our future rests on what they make of that someday.
Where is your planetarium show going to be available to see?
Well, Evans and Sutherland, which I am a subcontractor for, has a series of shows that they've produced that are... they also sell the projection equipment and such. And so every year or so, I end up creating the animation for a new show. I've done about 8 of them so far. And full dome video is just really an amazing medium to work in. Many of us are familiar with the traditional planetarium where we're sitting in a big round room with the seating arranged concentrically around this large ant-like projector in the middle. Well, those days are gone, at least for the new facilities. no longer do we need a dedicated star projector in the middle. And they were pretty nice, but they were basically an expensive, clunky, one-trick pony. Now they utilize video projection along wherever it is convenient to put the projectors. They fill the dome with a animated image, a full hemisphere that basically immerses you in some exotic environment. Most of what I do is space-related, although there was one show on the Seven Wonders of the Ancient World where I recreated architectural wonders from the past. And so I do all the modeling myself. I do all the animating and, of course, all the artwork and deliver these 4,000-pixel-wide circular format fisheye views that are shown 30 frames a second on the dome. And while I can say this, I will. I don't know how long I'll be able to say this, but as of now, I've created by far more content for full-dome astronomical animation than any other person. But I've been in the business for 10 years as well.
Where will this show be seen? Do you know the planetarium?
They don't, unfortunately. They license it out to various places. So there's probably a good couple of dozen full-dome theaters showing such material, but I don't know of any easy way to, aside from checking the websites of full-dome video-capable planetariums and seeing what their shows are. Like, you can always request one of the shows, too. I have a trailer for the latest one I did on called Violent Universe that's at near the end of the bio section of my website. That one was particularly fun because impacts were one of the things I spent a great deal, perhaps more effort studying than anything else in my USGS days, where there were a number of people whose brains I could pick on the subject. One of them, David Roddy. Roddy was a wonderful fellow, and he was working with, back then, the Atomic Energy Commission, various places, and working with studying the effects of nuclear explosions. And so I studied all these reports and again, talked with people who were thoroughly immersed in the subject, and I basically learned to run the process through in my head. And now I create paintings based on that. I did a series of paintings for the Meteor Crater Museum, which, unfortunately, last I heard, they took them down. But that was in 1982. I did a series of oil paintings. They may still sell a set of postcards of that, though. And I've done animations of impacts and such. And so for this latest show, I did one of the Tunguska fireball over Siberia in 1908, which was created almost 100 years to the day after the event. And then one of the formation of Meteor Crater in Arizona, as well as some other more distant things, like a gamma ray burst. Anyway, it's lots of fun.
We're going to take our next break. John, do you have any other questions for him?
Yeah. Do you ever do anything where you visualize events or situations outside the normal visible light range? In other words, image things symbolically that are normally in ultraviolet light or something of that nature?
Once in a while, if I'm doing, I've done pictures of jets coming from the centers of galaxies where I'm showing stuff that's mostly off the visible wavelength. That's one example. But as far as my space art, I tend to keep it more towards the visual wavelengths just to have more to relate to that somebody who's familiar with the subject matter might be able to more readily grasp.
I see. Super. Well, it was nice talking to you, and I'll sign off for somebody else, okay?
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And everybody stay where you are. We're going to take our next break, and we'll be back with our final segment for the show and more discussion with your questions in about 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Space Show. And again, our guest is Don Davis, space artist, animator, much more. For those of you wanting to chat with us at Space Show Chat, I've rebooted the system. Hopefully that will make it visible to some of you who are having trouble seeing it. If you do have a problem, please email me. But rebooting should work. Let's keep our fingers crossed. Don, during the break, we were talking about how long it might take and, you know, before the private sector and other things start to accomplish some of the things we've been talking about tonight. And you actually see our times as a time of opportunity, right?
Yes. I think that in order to do some of these grand schemes that we dream of, we're given the knowledge and some of the experience needed after Apollo. And again, a space colony ideas, they emerged in that early post-Apollo era of possibilities and kind of consolidating what visions our future may have for it and such. But I have the impression that we are now, being 2010, we're sort of midway in this targeted opportunity, I think, more or less. It's hard to say, but it seems that as time passes, it will be more and more difficult to do some of these things, and not less so. I worry about the state of the worldwide economy and such, as the resources get kind of forcibly redistributed to the entire world. The living standards of the first world countries will probably decline, and things like generous space programs will look even more wild and out of place than they do today to many people. You probably saw that Rasmussen poll, by the way, that recent poll.
Well, I saw both of them. I've talked about them on air, the one where 50% say that we should cut NASA's budget, and the other one said only 40% of the people think the space shuttle has been worth the cost.
Yeah, it's not a good time, and especially when the economy is not at its best, to try to sell grand ideas and such like that. But I think that we'll have a number of decades and we can still act, not as many as we'd like, but at some point the world will become probably too poor and too worried about maintenance of the populations and such to make such things possible. But hey, I could be wrong.
Well, I think the path through space makes the world a much better place. And I guess what I don't understand is why this is such a difficult concept for politicians and even for many of the younger people to appreciate, to understand, and to grab hold of and run with the ball. I never hear politicians talk about space as a solution set for anything. I certainly don't hear it from the non-space cadet younger people that I know. I mean, certainly I hear it from those already involved in space in one way or another and active in it. They certainly get it, but that's a small percentage of the population.
Yeah, we're space fans, so we have a skewed idea of the prominence historically of this subject, I think. Most people, it's just a rather obscure subject like history or something. That's the impression I have.
But, you know, as I was saying earlier, the space art helped drive and inspire and shape me, and I know that that's true for a lot of other people. And I hate to think it's just because we're of a certain generation or age group. I mean, maybe Tom Corbett is certainly dated, and, you know, I can understand that. But the video games that the kids play, I mean, most of it is shoot 'em up, kill 'em up, alien stuff. It's not anything, you know, like what we watched. But I don't know. I just hope it's not dated to, you know, older and past generations. And somehow, you know, there is a younger group other than just the space cadets that can grab hold of this. Rasmussen's poll that you talked about. The younger groups outside the space cadet families, really low interest in space, low interest in going to the moon, low interest in Mars, all of
very
that.
Very little relevance to their lives,
yeah,
frankly.
Totally. I mean, God, when if you talk to us when we were growing up in the 50s, and we talked, our fantasies were about going to Mars and moon and traveling the stars.
Historically, I think that was in the context also of the post-war affluence of the United States. We had all kinds of dreams, and you look back at the aircraft prototypes that were being created, all kinds of things like the flying wing and flying flapjack and all these. And nowadays, to create a new aircraft, it's just a much more of an immense undertaking. And the resources that go into one bomber now went into 1,000 bombers back in the World War II era. So it's getting more and more expensive to make fundamental breakthroughs. The history of the recent efforts to develop space planes after the shuttle, each one of them seemed to have died a protracted, agonizing death. And there are certain ceilings we're reaching, perhaps, which it's so expensive that it becomes harder and harder to make fundamental breakthroughs, perhaps.
Well, except we're watching great space planes being made by the private groups in Mojave, and primarily in Mojave.
When they can get into orbit, then we will truly be somewhere. As Heinlein said, you're halfway to practically anywhere once you get into orbit.
What about the suborbital group that's about to take off?
Well, I applaud. You got to start somewhere. So I think it's great that we're taking these first steps and such. But I can't see spending a huge amount of money just to spend a few minutes in a suborbital hop. I just don't see it. But I'm sure that it'd be an incredible thrill for many a person who's got a bunch of money.
Here's a chat question for you. Hi, Don. This is a question from your old friend Robin Snelson, now serving as Executive Director of Space Studies Institute, which moved last year from Princeton to Mojave Spaceport. You've expressed interest in making a full-dome movie about how we settled space, looking back from the future. How could this help advance the cause? David, do not paraphrase or you get noogies. Thank you. I didn't paraphrase, Robin. I read it exactly as it is.
Well, we have, I think, a need for a new vision, something like what the Disney Man in Space TV specials provided for that generation. And to me, the most impressive visual medium that I work in is full-dome planetarium media. So I know how I could create a space colonization-oriented short film. And so if I can get backing for it and such, I have the screenplay practically in my head. And what I don't have, I can get from other interested parties. So that's I have aspirations to elevating the art of a full-dome planetarium projection to more of a cinematography medium. And I even have a science fiction scenario in my head that I'm at least I can write it down, even if only the most fortuitous of circumstances are likely to allow such a thing to be made. But the space colony idea, I think, would be a great full dome spectacle to just be surrounded with a futuristic vision of a new planetary home that we create ourselves. By the way, I would like to mention that I think that the space colony idea is far more a short-term and likely path for expansion of humanity than ideas of terraforming another world. I know that's been a long-standing dream of people as well, but I just don't see that as being a fruitful way to go.
I'm curious, what would it cost to do your full dome space colonization short film? If you were out, you know, beating the brush for funds, what kind of funding does it take to do that?
I would estimate that $300K to $500K.
And is there an estimated return on investment for people, or is it
a
grant?
That's the thing. It's tough to make money in this business yet because there are so few theaters showing such full domes. So it's a little bit, it may even be premature, but on the other hand, new full dome theaters are opening almost every week and such. So some kind of gate sharing or some kind of means of getting a percentage of the gate or whatever would have to be arranged. I guess funds could trickle in. There has been one or two full dome productions that have made money, but it's a bit uphill on that end. But on the other hand, once you have something in existence that you can promote, then you're a long ways along in the process.
You know, I don't know if they're full dome, but and maybe you do, so for my own knowledge, maybe you can clarify. The planetarium at Chabot over in the East Bay of the Bay Area and also the brand new planetarium in San Francisco, are they full dome planetarium?
Yes, both of them are. Chabot was somewhat older, and they have a modest tilted dome. Tilted domes, by the way, are the way to go as far as new planetariums as well. And the designers of the new Morrison have taken that very much to heart. And so they have, I forget, 25 or 30 degree tilt, a very pronounced tilt. The nice thing about that is when you have a tilted dome and you're sitting in these unidirectional seats, you can arrange a landscape or a scene where the horizon is truly at eye level for much of the audience. Whereas in traditional planetariums, you're kind of in a large, round, open pit where the horizon is this contrived thing above the cove level at the bottom of the dome. And it's just another step of suspension of disbelief you're asking of the audience. So the potential of creating an environment, say the inside of an ancient building or such, where you could create a beautiful architectural scene. And for somebody sitting near the middle of the dome, all the lines appear straight that should, and it's just a remarkable thing.
Listeners, for those of you that may find yourself as a tourist or visiting San Francisco, visiting the new Morrison Planetarium in Golden Gate Park really is an incredible experience. And I would really recommend it. I don't know what shows they have there. They change from time to time. But it is an amazing experience, and so I'm glad to know that's what you're talking about. Do you have something to say? Otherwise, I have another question for you.
No, I'll take the question.
Robin sent in another question. Don, if someone gave you a free ride on a suborbital spaceship, would you take the ride?
Of course I would, although I still have to go through a bunch of physical tests and stuff, but if I could pass that, yeah, I'd go. I'd take a camera and take pictures, but the answer, I guess, in short, is yes.
Would you do a series of paintings before and after the experience?
Well, maybe after. Before, I don't know what to anticipate what I think I might see.
Uh-huh.
I kind of know what I'm going to see. I've seen so many photos of high-altitude balloon pictures and stuff, but to see something like that, of course, if the timing was such, I don't know if they have to do them all during daytime, but if it were done near twilight or something, you could have a very unforgettable sight. But whatever, I'm just thinking out loud.
I don't know about the timing.
Was there a launch constraint, or they have to do them all during the middle of the day, or what?
I don't know. You know, in all the years I've been doing this, nobody's ever mentioned that.
Just a thought.
an interesting thought. You'd certainly have a different perspective depending on the time of the day.
You could time it around sunset and such, and by the time you're up there, you'd see the sun again. And
I don't know. I think also sun up would be a remarkable
either
time
one,
to do it.
Certainly, yeah. If it's within view of your where you can take pictures of it or shoot some high def video. They ought to figure out ways of attaching video to the external of services of such vehicles, so we can get more of the kind of stunning footage that we're seeing more and more of from NASA with all of those external cameras they have on the shuttle and such. Those, to me, are the most incredible videos, especially the ones from the SRBs where you're seeing the other SRBs spiraling away, and then as we enter the atmosphere, the structure groans and vibrates almost like a sinking ship, the spooky sound. It's really interesting stuff.
Alex in Portland, Oregon, has this question for you. We're about to see an announcement for a new civil space policy for the United States. From your experience, do you think it matters if we're pushing forward to go to Mars, to return to the moon, or something different? What would be your preference in terms of what would be best for supporting and moving us forward into the type of vision you've been talking about tonight?
I think the best, most accessible destination for now, I know there's controversy about this, is the moon. I occasionally think about the days when I saw the last lunar expedition, and I remember being at Rick Sternbach's parents' house and seeing Harrison Schmitt raising his visor and giving us one of the few glimpses of a human face on the moon that we could relate to. And then I went outside into the snowy front yard and looked up at the moon in the sky and then thought, how long will it be until I can see the moon up there in the sky and know that there are people on there right now? And so I think periodically, if I could ever see people on the moon again on video, I would just weep hysterically in joy. There's another option of the unmanned means of going of exploration that I think deserves further consideration, and who knows, maybe Avatar indirectly will get people thinking about this. So the idea of a virtual experience. We could have an advanced rover on the moon with, you know, minimal time delay and basically have it set up to be an advanced VR-type rover where people who are properly equipped or perhaps sitting in a full-dome theater with a constant update projected, where you could have an experience darn near as complete as being in a pressurized rover actually on the surface. And people could share that by the thousands, by the millions perhaps. And I think that would be a better way of sharing space exploration than to kind of look over the shoulder of a few chosen people that actually get to make the trip and just see what develops that way. Mars has its own potential in that regard, but the light travel time makes it more of an issue from Earth. I like the idea of sending a significant orbiting manned vehicle that would drop several rovers onto interesting places on Mars, too risky to send people down on. And you'd have a bunch of rovers and send those down and control them in real time from orbit, and then hand off the control after they have to go back to Earth to facilities on the Earth and maybe universities. When one university or another, they could maintain the control of the rover. They could have people from their photography department, or art department, or whatever, that would have dibs on taking pictures with the camera. As time goes on, we're going to see more and more video used in future rovers. I guess the Mars Science Lab, if it makes it to the surface on that sky crane, is going to have a video capability. And so with the ability to shoot time lapse and such, I think the ability to share events, including the landing, is going to go a long ways towards making people excited. When I saw the Japanese Kaguya spacecraft images, and I have some of these in high definition, that was one of the greatest images ever returned from the vicinity of the moon. And the first time I began to feel left out as an American in the possibilities. And we're sure we're getting wonderful information now, and that'll allow us to create unprecedented models and maps of the moon and such. And I just hope that in the future the idea of taking a high-def camera occurs to more and more people in these mission planning.
Well, you know, with the advent of 3D television, which is already here but coming big time, probably starting later this year. Think of the opportunities for what you've just talked about in NASA TV.
Oh, sure. There's lots of 3D content that they could just have a 3D hour and put on material. And as long as they do it right and don't make it look like propaganda for kids or something.
Well, they need to get you to design the programming.
Well, I think that one, if I had to make one suggestion, it would be to have a fellow with a photographic eye at the control of some of the cameras that are already in orbit, where they could maneuver the camera to photogenic places on Earth where we're not just seeing hardware in the foreground all the time, but we're seeing the destination and less of the means of being there.
Yeah, it doesn't look like having a photographic eye is an essential prerequisite for working any of the cameras or anything. They don't impress me as being artistic in nature or figuring out, you know, the best kind of shot to take or
especially
something.
Especially
like
the low-level nighttime stuff is intriguing. You can see lightning storms, occasional meteors, the air glow layer, that this soft layer glowing above the nighttime Earth, and, of course, the stars. They've got the cameras, and there's lots of wonderful things out there that the pipeline could be smoothed along to share these things with a potential public. I think that it would be helpful.
Stephen in Albuquerque, New Mexico, has sent in a question, and he says, do you have a recommendation or do you know of what people can do who share the kind of vision you're talking about tonight can work to make it happen?
Yeah, they can talk up the idea among all of their friends and acquaintances and at least try to diffuse the concept to their immediate surroundings. And the more and more people do that, the more word of mouth takes place of something that is culturally interesting, the wider the base of interest will gradually be.
So basically you're saying spread it word of mouth.
Yes, there's always a chance. I guess you could write your congressman and such, too, talk about how great space exploration is and such. But on the other hand, as private companies start emerging, the destinations you're going to be people should write letters to will probably change.
Absolutely. I'm betting that the private sector over time is going to play more and more of an important role in this area than the government space program. But I guess time will tell. And there's not too many private space programs in other countries that have a national space program. It's almost all national. When you go to India, when you go to most of the European countries, Russia, so it's much harder. It's like the pressure is on the United States entrepreneurial community to lead the way.
I guess we're still considered to be the most affluent place where such dreams have some hope of getting somewhere.
Well, I think so, although maybe in terms of affluence in general, China might be overtaking us. I haven't seen the latest statistics on that, but I certainly think in terms of dreams, as you just depicted it, yeah, the United States is probably it. I know from people sending me emails every week from around the world, and if I counted them, it would range anywhere from maybe 20 to 50 or 60 emails a week because of this show. Almost all of them talk about the U.S. as the hope for pushing all of these dreams and these visions forward. And they wish their country allowed the kind of economic and personal choice freedoms that we have in this country. And they almost always say, Don, that we Americans have no clue what we have and have no clue how to appreciate what we have.
Well, this sort of falls in with the idea that we are in a target of opportunity. We have a capability of doing something about it still and will for some decades to come. And so the ideas are out there, and we just need the critical mass of people to decide that it's worth doing. It almost happened in the 70s with the space colony movement, and I thought that was a very healthy thing. With the Coevolution Quarterly magazine published a bunch of essays by thinkers in their circles and such. And Stuart Brand, he was very interested in that subject. I did, in fact, my Golden Gate Bridge Space Colony painting was the cover of the issue devoted to that subject. And who knows, maybe the threshold of interest will emerge and be prominent once again. It's unpredictable how history goes.
Well, I think we have a core of great people in this country and around the world that can push it forward if we do it. So I think really the pressure, if that's the right word, is on all of us to turn into reality what you've been talking about tonight. And we'll see if we can do it.
Indeed.
As we move toward the end of the program tonight, first of all, if people have comments or want to get back in touch or ask you a question, do you give out an email address or should I filter for you?
That's a good question. Would you mind filtering for me a little?
No, I know you've got a spelled out address on your website.
Yes, they can contact me through that address on the website if they want. I guess that's good enough. It's unlikely to be flooded with emails, but I'm always interested in people who are curious about the subject and such, and it's always fun to hear from people who are fellow space fans.
What should I ask you, or what do you want to talk about that I've omitted or forgotten or skipped over?
I think we've covered a fair range. I could always think of more things down the road, but I think we've done a fairly good job, and it's the end of the show, so I'm sure I'll think of some glaring omission that I wish I'd brought up, or some person who I failed to give proper credit to, but I'm sure they won't. I'm sure there'll be no hard feelings, but it's been actually quite a bit of fun, and appreciate your having me on.
Closing comments, pearls of wisdom you'd like to leave with the listeners tonight?
Space is the place.
I've heard that before. you make a big painting with that road sign, right?
Yes.
And we'll do that. Well, listen, this has been delightful. I hope we can do it again down the road.
Oh, I'd be happy to someday.
Your ideas, your vision, you know, they're worth tapping into for energy and creativity on a regular basis. And I really appreciate having gotten to know you and bring you and your work to the Space Show listening audience. And it's been great. And I really hope to do more programs with you as the year and as the years go down the road.
Well, thank you so much. I would be happy to.
And if you take that ride on a free ride, if you get one, we're going to link you up so you can do a live broadcast for us.
Okay.
Thank you very much for being here. And listeners, on behalf of Don Davis, as well as myself and the Space Show, have a great night. And we're doing open lines at an unusual time, Friday. I'm trying that to see if we get some more outside of the United States responses, given the time zone differences. So it's obviously it's designed for everybody, but hopefully it will be a time that works for people in Europe and outside the United States, and it's an experiment, so we'll see what happens. Again, thanks to Don Davis and all of you, and back Friday with our Open Lines program. Good night from the Space Show.